What I'd like to do today is do another book. A book that is not quoted in the New Testament at all. We don't even know exactly when it was written. We don't know who wrote it. And a book where God is not so much as even mentioned. But we understand that all Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is highly profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, and for instruction in righteousness, which is 2 Timothy 3, verse 16. And that all these things happened unto them for examples, and that they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come, which is 1 Corinthians 10, 11. So, what can we learn from this book? So, if you want to turn to the book of Esther, following on from Ruth. Ruth, of course, who was a Moabitess married to an Israelite. And here we have a Jewess who ends up being married to a Gentile. But as we'll see, a very, very important marriage it was. So let's turn to Esther 1 verse 1. Obviously there's 10 chapters, we can't go through them all, so we'll hit the high points. And as we go along, we'll see some of the points. And at the end, I think you'll find that there's something very interesting actually hidden in this book that can only be understood if you have the Holy Spirit. So we'll start off in verse 1. It came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, that is the Ahasuerus who reigned from India even to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. So this man ruled over all the known world, in other words, in those days. That in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which is in Shushan, the palace. And Shushan is in Iran, and it's about 150 miles east of the Tigris River. Or what's left of it, should I say. In the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. Now, there's something interesting there, because if you think about the Bible, you think of this time, you always think of the Medes and the Persians, don't you? But in Esther, it's completely different. It's the Persians and the Medes. Now, remember that day there, the third year of his reign, because this becomes quite important as we go along. Because when you read these books, you get the impression that all this happened within a very compressed amount of time. But that is not so, as we'll see. And drop down to verse 10. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, I would have rather thought it was a bit more than merry after 7 days of imbibing, he commanded, it looks like the seven wise men, he won't forget all their names, the seven chamberlains that served in the presence of Ahasuerus the king, to bring Vashti the queen before the king, with the royal crown to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look at. Verse 12, but the queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment by his chamberlains. Therefore was the king wroth. If you want it in a bit of Yorkshire, he was dischuffed. And his anger burned within him. You didn't do this kind of thing to a king back in those days. Not if you wanted to stay alive. And if drop down to verse 15. So the sort of elders got together, the king, and they said, what should we do unto the queen Vashti according to law? Now remember, the Persians and the Medes were very strong on law. You remember with Daniel, once it had been put into law by the king, it could not be altered in any way. So he said, what should we do according to the law? Because she had not performed the commandment of the king as a Ahasuerus by the chamberlains. And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Vashti the queen hath not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes and to all the people that are in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus. So they're making a huge case for what the queen actually did. Verse 17, for this deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes when it shall be reported. The king Ahasuerus commanded Vashti the queen to be brought before him, and she came not. Likewise shall all the ladies of Persia and Media say that this day unto all the king's princes, we have heard of the deed of the queen, thus shall there arise too much contempt and wrath. They were worried that because of what had happened, it could disrupt family life within the kingdom. Now, anybody who studied history knows that when a country, when a nation is great, you will find the family life is very, very strong. When the nation starts falling apart, it goes in line with marriages. And when we have today more than 50% of people living together and not being married, and you look at the mess we're in, you see that the graph is quite correct. Verse 19, now here's the solution they come up with. If it please the king, let there go out a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, that it be not altered, that Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal estate unto another that is better than she. Now keep that point in mind, because we'll come back to that a bit later on. Verse 20, and when the king's decree, which he shall make, shall be published throughout all of his empire, for his great, all the wives shall give to their husbands honour, both great and small. And the saying pleased the king, verse 21, and the princes and the king did according to the words of Memucan. Verse 22, for he sent letters unto all the king's provinces, into every province according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language. Remember, this empire crossed a lot of language barriers. This was not a simple job. They didn't have Google's interpretation service and so on. They didn't have the internet. This all took a vast amount of time. That every man should bear rule in his own house. That, from what I can see, is the only allusion that you could put towards the New Testament when it talks about somebody wants to be an elder, he should be one that rules well his own house. But it's not a direct quote. And that this should be published according to the language of every people. So this went down through the whole empire. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. Some of the commentaries say that it could well be that he had acted somewhat rashly. But whatever happened, it was done, and he couldn't go back on it. So now, of course, they've got to sort of keep the king happy. So they come up with another idea. Verse 2 of chapter 2. Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, saying, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan the palace, to the house of the women, unto the custody of, I presume it's Hedge, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women, and let their things for purification be given them. And let the maiden which pleased the king, the king be queen instead of Vashti. And the thing pleased the king, and he did so. So if you can imagine this, letters went around the whole of the known world at that time, and any young damsel who was sort of nice looking got hauled away to the palace. And we don't know how many there would have been, but when you see the time frame, you will realize that it's quite a large number. So the king was rather busy, and it was years rather than weeks and months. Verse 5. Now we come to one of the main characters. Some people have actually said that this book should be called Mordecai and not Esther, because Mordecai is mentioned a lot more times than Esther is, believe it or not. But it's not. It's called Esther because the way God wants it. Now in Shushan the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. This is quite important. We'll come back to that one a bit later. Mordecai was possibly one of the princes, because this is what they did. Well, it's when the Babylonian captivity actually happened. They took people like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and so on. They were taken captive, but they didn't sling them in dungeons. They used them. They used the ability of these men in governance. And it also helped to keep the empire together when, you know, you'd been clobbered by some greater power. But at least your guys were still involved in the government. So Mordecai sat in the gate. And later on, you'll see another character, Haman, who also sat in the gate. But he's a different character. So let's go back now. Verse 6. Who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. We're talking here about the most turbulent time in world history. Probably ever. Because you have the fall of Israel. You have the fall of Judah. You have the rise of Assyria. Then Assyria goes down and Babylon comes up. Then Babylon gets beaten down by the Persians and the Medes. All within the space of 100 or so years. Quite a turbulent time. You know, one minute there was this king, and the next minute somebody else completely different was running, you know, what was going on there. So Mordecai, verse 7, he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther. Now it would seem that the possibilities are that Hadassah was her Hebrew name, and that Esther was actually, in fact, her Persian name. His uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter. So she was basically an orphan. And in a sense, he did the same as Boaz. He was her redeemer. He took her under his wing. He brought her up and paid all the expenses that are accompanied for her. She became literally his daughter. So it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decree were heard, and when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan the palace, to the custody of Hegiah, that Esther was brought unto the king's house, to the custody of Hegiah, keeper of the women. Now these men, of course, were all eunuchs, for obvious reasons. And they were very powerful. They were very powerful. And you'll see, the women knew that if they wanted to get anything out of life, they had to be on the right side of these men, these eunuchs. And it says, verse 9, and the maiden pleased him, and she obtained kindness of him, and he speedily gave her things for purification, and such things as belonged to her, and seven maidens, which were meet to be given her, out of the king's house. And he preferred her and her maids unto the best place of the house of the women. So right from the beginning, we see Esther, who is taken from her home, put into this palace, and immediately she's granted tremendous favor. She's given the support, she's given seven other women to help her, and she's given preferential treatment by the head man. Right from the beginning, she is shown favor. She's very interesting. Verse 10. Esther had not showed her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. Now this is vital to the story. She was a Jewess, and she was in line to marry the king of Persia. A situation of great honor and privilege. And Mordecai had said to her, just keep the background out of this. Just keep it right out. The fact that she was Jewish would have been a problem. So she obeyed Mordecai. She only revealed her nationality in chapter 7, verse 3, which we'll come to later, when she had to. Several years later. Now, the point here that I want to bring up, first of all, over the years in the church, I've seen a lot of people get into a lot of trouble. When I was first in the church, before I was even baptized, Mr. Waterhouse stressed, there was a group of us, and he got us together, and he said, look, learn this if you learn nothing else. There are two types of people on this planet. There are those God is working with, and there is the rest. Those he's working with are a mere handful of people, right? A mere handful. But he says, once God is working you, even if you've not been baptized, he's opened your mind, and you don't think anymore as people in the world think. You start seeing things in a completely different light. You start understanding the Sabbath. You start understanding the holidays. You start to get an understanding possibly of God's plan. You start to see what you have to do. You're looking forward, say, to baptism. There's all sorts of, it's all new that's coming to you. And the tendency is you get excited about it and you want to tell everybody. Big mistake. Big mistake. I think I see a few people smiling. Haven't we all put our foot in it at some stage? Oh. And yet, you know, if you get it right, it's quite amazing what happens. I was the only one in my house. My mum and dad didn't say anything. So I thought, well, I'll do what I'm told. I left the plain truth lying on the side of the bed anyway, you see. And I noticed it had been moved slightly now and again, but it was still there. And the most amazing thing is I thought it was my mother that was interested, and it wasn't, it was my father. And my father and I actually got baptized on the same day, in just before Passover in 1964. My mother was never in the church. She helped people over the years. She did all sorts of things. She cooked for people. She remembered to repair their clothes. She babysat for people. She did all sorts, but she was just not called. It went right over the head. And it always amazed me. Right to her dying day, she was just not turned on. The fuse, as Mr. Armstrong once said, you know, when you get the Holy Spirit, it's just like the whole circuit's there, but God just puts the fuse in, and then that circuit works. And suddenly you have a different spirit. So what I want to bring out here, and it's perhaps to an audience like this, partially a waste of time, because we've been around so long, most of us, but there are probably younger people out there that need to learn this one. Matthew 10, verse 16, if you want to just read this, because this is a key verse. This is a key verse. Matthew 10 and verse 16. Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Now, you know, doves are stupid, aren't they? The number of times you come so close to running over them in the car, they'll sit there pecking at stuff on the road right to the last minute. We used to catch them when I was a child in Rhodesia. We used to catch them. We devised all sorts of traps. And you know, you always caught doves. You always caught doves. You never caught anything else. The rest of the birds are too wary for that. And wise as a serpent? Is a serpent wise? Well, you know, a serpent's got a problem. He's kind of like close to the ground. And they can move alarmingly quickly if they're coming towards you. But most of the time, you very rarely see them. Very rarely see them. I know in all my time in Southern Africa, if I saw 10, 12 snakes, that's all. Why? Because they're clever. They know that anything on two legs is, generally speaking, not friendly. My attitude towards snakes is the best snake in the world is one that is cut into pieces 1 inch long and kept very separate from each other, because I've seen what they can do. I got bitten when I was a youngster in Rhodesia. I was wearing shorts, walking through the long grass, and suddenly felt this searing pain on the inside of my leg, just above the knee. You know, that soft, tender tissue there? And I looked down. Here's a snake chonking on my leg. And it's about 4 foot long. And, of course, you can imagine panic set in. So I grabbed the thing by the head, which opened its mouth and got it off me. And then I had about 2 miles back to the doctor's, holding this wretched snake, which, of course, had coiled around my arm. And I got into the doctor's surgery, and the woman just took one look at me, and she burst out laughing. Oh, she says, you've squashed the poor little thing's head off. Evidently, it was a totally harmless snake. But I didn't know that. But that is evidently quite unusual. I must have bumped into the thing or something. Normally, a snake hears a person approaching and it just disappears. It doesn't want trouble. It stays out of trouble. Because it knows that it's very vulnerable, particularly to people like us. Some people actually have them for pets, I believe. Yes. It takes all kinds. Esther was in the midst of wolves, wasn't she? She was in the midst of wolves. Remember, she was an alien. She was an alien in a foreign country. We are aliens in a foreign country. She was married to Ahasuerus for 6 years. 6 long years before she told him she was Jewish. That takes some doing. But you see, he didn't see a Jewess. He saw a beautiful woman who obeyed him and who loved him. And he loved her too. So the Jewish bit didn't matter. But she brought it up at just the right time. Just like Esther, our beliefs are best kept to ourselves. This is Satan's world, and people out there don't understand. You know, try explaining the plan of God to somebody. You may as well, as Mr. Armstrong said, go down to the zoo and try and explain it to a chimpanzee. Just like Esther, we don't have to volunteer information as to what we believe. You know, in 1 Peter 3:15, it says, you know, give an answer to every man that asks you for a reason of the hope that's within you. And even then you've got to be careful, because you have the answer a fool according to his folly, or answer not a fool according to his folly. What's the attitude of the person? Are they genuinely interested, or are they antagonistic? You see, this is where the wisdom comes in. Christ also applied this principle. While he never lied, he didn't foolishly blurt out for unasked for truth. You check that in John 18 when he was being tried before Pilate. Are you a king? He says, well, some say so. I mean, here was the perfect opportunity for Christ to say, okay, I'll spill the beans, right? I'm going to die now to cover the sins of the whole of mankind for all time. And then I'm going to be ready. After 3 days, I'm going to come back. I'm going to walk around on the, you know, on the earth again for another 40 days or so. And then I'm going to ascend into the heaven. And I'm going to be up there with God the Father and for 2,000 years. And then I'm going to come back on a white horse with a big sword and a whole bunch of other guys with me. And we're going to take over the whole world. Oh, and by the way, we're going to take Satan and we're going to stick him down a hole and seal him up for a whole 1,000 years. Can you imagine Pilate? Right. Yes. You see, it wouldn't work, would it? He had the wisdom and he just answered the bare minimum to get him through what he knew he had to go through. The other thing where we should avoid standing out like a sore thumb is dress. We should avoid extremes. I remember when I went to Ambassador College, this was 1964, September 1964, and we had a few days before college started, and I went down to London. Now, having come from South Africa, which was a very conservative, shall we say, culture, where everybody dressed very modestly, we went down to London, and here were all these girls wearing sort of pelmets or mini skirts. You know, you felt like saying, that's a nice skirt you're almost wearing, you know. We couldn't believe it. We just could not believe that people would go down a main street dressed like this. But that's what they did. And we should avoid the other extreme. We have the Mennonites in the States, you know, they have dresses on the floor and they drive around horses and buggies. They just will not embrace the 21st or the 20th century even. So they stand out because they look odd. They look odd and they stand out. Then people automatically put you into the limelight. When people start saying, what are you doing dressing like this? What do you believe? You know, what sort of wacky religion is this? I remember Mr. Armstrong, when we had that first year, we used to have an assembly every week. When he was there, he took it and we'd cover some subject. And it was this thing with skirt lengths, because some of the girls, the dresses were starting to creep above the knee a little bit. And after going on for a while, he said, if you think about it, knees are hinges. And hinges, the hinge is not the most beautiful part of a door. So he said, cover them up, ladies. And then he said, you know, if you've got to ask, is my dress too short? He said, it probably is. You know, the way he did things. I mean, Christ's example here is the same. He dressed just the same as everybody else. He looked the same as everybody else. In fact, he looked so much the same that Judas had to literally grab him and kiss him to betray him, so they knew who they were getting, that they were getting the right man. So you see, as far as we can, we've got to remember, we are aliens in a foreign country, all of us. No matter where you live on the face of this planet, if you are a true Christian with God's spirit, you are an alien living in a foreign culture. This is not our culture. Our culture is totally, totally different. This is Satan's world we're living in. So that's the key. If you're an alien in a foreign land, as some people who survived the war will well know, if you're in an occupied country, you know what you do? You keep your head down. You don't attract attention to yourself. Because if you do, you get the wrong kind of attention. So that's something that Esther did, and she lived in the palace for all those years, and nobody knew she was a Jewish. The time will soon come when we will have to stand up for our beliefs, as did Esther. But even then, the rule still applies. Wise as serpents, harmless as doves. You don't have to blurt everything out. You just answer the question. And, you know, Christ said in that time, we're not to even worry about what to say because the Holy Spirit will show us what to say. So it's quite important that we learn that lesson from Esther. Because she was in a real position. She wasn't just in the world. She was in the palace of the world ruler at that time. She had to walk very circumspectly. Now, the timing of when this book was written is interesting. It's obviously in the period when Persia was on top. Now, Bullinger says, and again, you know, these commentaries that are a bit like what Mr. Bowles mentioned about translations, they are fascinating. They're very interesting. The men who wrote them, I mean, for instance, Bullinger, Clark's commentary, Cruden's Concordance, and so on. These men wrote by candlelight. They took years, the amount of reading, they must have read the Bible backwards to get all these references and cross-references and going into the... If you want to waste a whole day, here's how you waste a whole day, right? Get a bunch of textbooks on the kings of Persia and try and work out who's who. And then, for an encore, try and work out who was who when. Because they've got a Persian name, they've got a Greek name, some of them have got a Hebrew name. And some of them ruled one after the other, and some of them ruled at the same time. Right? So you see how confusing it is? However, we know that after this event, I'll read you what Bullinger says first. Bullinger says, quote, "All this proves that these events must have taken place before the emancipation made by Cyrus, recorded in Esther chapter 1. Remember when Cyrus, God moved Cyrus and the decree was issued that the Jews could go back to build the temple? Okay, that's when the Jews were emancipated. They were totally inculcated into the Persian Empire. They were basically became freemen in a sense. And then they were sent, some were sent back, and we know that story. I mean, we've gone through Ezra and Nehemiah. And he says, all this proves that these events must have taken place before the emancipation made by Cyrus, recorded in Ezra chapter 1. No such secrecy would have been necessary, and no thought of allowing the people whom he had just emancipated to be exterminated, as described in the book of Esther. You see, that's what we're coming to, aren't we? Haman wanted all the Jews exterminated. Nothing new there. And what was his name? Jochen? Is it, I should have made a note of it. It was Hitler's propaganda minister. Yeah, when he went to the gallows, he was heard to say Purim 1946. Purim 1946. Because Purim, as we'll see, became almost a religious festival of the Jews to celebrate the saving of the Jews from the tyranny of this man Haman. And he, as a Nazi, was referring to the fact that they tried to exterminate the Jews. And Purim had taken its course. And he was the one going to the gallows, which is very interesting. So, he had, you know, they wouldn't have done this if they hadn't been emancipated. Now, he says, this is what he says, but Cyrus, being Esther's son, would have been carefully prepared by her and Mordecai to begin his reign by such emancipation from Babylon. Now, it's very difficult because you can't turn to a chapter and a verse and say, there it is. However, there is a Mordecai with Nehemiah when they go back. Is it the same Mordecai? Again, we're not told. We're just not told. Twice, I think it is in Ezra, Mordecai's name comes up as a leader with Nehemiah. If the timing is as he says it is, then it would have been just about right. because she would have had Cyrus. Cyrus would have grown up because Cyrus took power and he was quite a young man. That would have been right. And the fact that he'd been brought up with a mother who was being guided and directed by God would have made him what he was, possibly. And of course, you go back to Isaiah, around about chapter 40 or thereabouts, and God calls Cyrus. He says, "Cyrus, my servant." And that was written 200 years before Cyrus was born. You see? So we can't nail this down, but it is very, very interesting to see who the players are at this particular time. Now, these women were all presented to the queen so that he could choose his future wife, and this took some time. This is Esther 2, verse 15 now. Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her for his daughter, was come to go into the king, she required nothing but what Haggai, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the women, appointed. Now, basically what it was all these women were kept in this mammoth palace. And when it came round to their turn to be presented to the king, this eunuch would have them in, and they would be given the choice of whatever they wanted. How did they want to dress? What jewelry did they want to wear? How did they want to be made up or whatever? What sort of perfumery did they want to wear? They could actually stipulate exactly what they wanted to show themselves in the best light to the king. But you see, here again, Esther was different. When it was her time to go into the king, she required nothing but what Haggai, the king's chamberlain, the keeper of the women, appointed. So when he called her in and says, "What would you like?" She said, "What do you recommend?" And you know, when in a selling situation, isn't that what you want? You know, you have the client to say, "Well, what do you recommend I buy?" "Oh, mine. Here's the order, sign." But he, you know, she gained great favor with everybody she came into contact with. So Esther was taken into King Ahasuerus, into his house royal, on the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. So she was in the palace for 4 long years before she got presented to the king, because she was taken in the 3rd year. 4 years. So how many women did he have parading in front of him? It must have been quite a sight. Verse 17 of chapter 2. "And the king loved Esther above all women, and she had obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti." You know, you just read that, but think of it. This is 4 years went into this. Do you think he just took one look at her and said, "That's okay, I'll have that one"? He would have checked. He would have had reports back from this Haggai and all the rest of it. He'd have gone on their recommendations, and they all came back and they were all totally positive about this woman, because she had it all. She was beautiful. She had a brain. She had the right attitude for a woman in this particular society at this particular time. So it says the king loved Esther above all the women, and he made her queen. Now, 2 verse 18. "Then the king made a great feast unto all his princes and all his servants, even Esther's feast. And he made a release to the provinces and gave gifts according to the state of the king. And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai sat in the king's gate." Esther, verse 20. "Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people, as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther did the commandment of Mordecai, like as when she was brought up with him." Esther was now queen of the whole Persian Empire, and she was still obeying Mordecai. Very interesting point. Now, chapter 2, verse 21. Here is a very, very interesting 3 or 4 verses. Mordecai saves the king's life. Verse 21. "In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, 2 of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those who kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hands on the king Ahasuerus. So these two men obviously got a bit disenchanted about something. And the thing was known to Mordecai, pardon me, who told it unto Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. She didn't claim the credit. She said, this is a message from Mordecai. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore, they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. And that's the end of that little section. It's just like stuck in there. But keep this in mind, because this is what perpetrates the biggest put down in the whole creation. You will never ever get a better put down than what this set up. Esther 3 verse 1. After these things did Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha. Wouldn't it be all nice if we all spoke English? Or Hebrew. Can't you see how important it is? We have one language, right? One language where your yes is yes and your no is no. And not like English where you can say, with the old Brutus is an honorable man, isn't it? The very inflection in your voice changes the whole meaning of what we're saying. If you've ever listened, I'm not a great Shakespearean, but I've heard that speech. And it's brilliant. He starts off by saying, Brutus is an honorable man. And then it's, Brutus is an honorable man. And then it's, Brutus is an honorable man. And then it's, Brutus is an honorable man. And the very tone takes him from being on a pinnacle to throwing him in the dustbin. And he said the same words. That will not happen in the world tomorrow because the language will be pure. That's the kind of rubbish. I mean, people at college, oh, got to be English. The whole world speaks English. I think English is the worst language for this. You can twist it, but look at the jokes. Look at the cartoons. See how they just play on words. I'd hate to be a foreigner trying to learn this language, I tell you. Anyway, he took Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Keep that in mind, Agagite. He is an Amalekite. And advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were before him. So all these princes like Mordecai and Nehemiah and so on, there were dozens of them that they'd amassed in to help with the governing of this, well, world government basically is what we've got here. Haman got the top job. For the king and all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Now, the interesting bit is why? Well, possibly, this is my inspired margin. Mordecai would not bow down to an Amalekite against whom God had declared perpetual war. If you want to just make a note, take the time to read it. Exodus 17 verse 16, it says, for he said, because the Lord has sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. And here's the interesting point. Saul of the tribe of Benjamin spared Agag, the Amalekite, king of the Amalekites, and Saul ended up losing out, didn't he? He lost everything. Ended up going to the dark side, so to speak. Mordecai of the tribe of Benjamin had Haman, the Agagite, the Amalekite, killed, and he gained the kingdom. It's almost a fitting end to the story. The Benjaminite was given the job to start with, and a Benjaminite finished it. Just an interesting little bit there. This book is full of, when I started going through this, I thought, oh, this is going to be quite easy because it fits nicely into five parts, you see. Yes. Verse 3 of chapter 3. Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's commandment? There's no answer. The next verse just said, now it came to pass, when they spoke daily unto him, that he hearkened not to them. He wouldn't listen to them. That they then went and told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matter would stand. Because the rest of these, this is all politics. The rest of these princes were saying, we've got to grovel to this guy. I mean, he doesn't give you the impression he was a very nice man. a powerful man, a seeker of power, as we'll see in a minute. So he probably wasn't well liked. And the rest of them saw Mordecai just sitting there. Yeah, and all the others are all bowing and scraping. And then they start thinking, well, hey, what's going on here? So they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. Now, at this stage, Mordecai revealed who he was. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. That is an understatement. That is the understatement of the century, as we'll see. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. So here we have a 2,500 years ago version of Hitler, don't we? Get rid of all the Jews. Because you can bet that once they got into the kingdom of Persia, it wasn't long before they percolated up in the business world, just as they've done today. Now here's the plot, verse 7, chapter 3, verse 7. Again, listen to the timing. It's very interesting. In the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they, the prognosticators, this is now, cast Pur. That is the lot. That's what Purim means. It means the lot. Before Haman, from day to day, and from month to month, to the 12th month, that is the month of Adar. Now just think about this. Every day, these prognosticator characters would come in and they'd do their thing. They were trying to work out what Haman wanted. He wanted the most favorable day when all the gods would be with him, that he could wipe out these Jews. All because of his hatred of one man, basically. So he cast lots to find out. See how deep his hatred was. Every single day for a whole year, he went through this ritual with the prognosticators to arrive at the most fortunate date. And every day of the year, he had to walk right past Mordecai, who sat there with his arms folding, looking him straight in the eye, while everybody else was buying and scraping. Get the picture. He was boiling. He was a pressure cooker, he'd have steam coming out of his ears. Just like Satan, he was going up, he was seeking whom he could destroy, wasn't he? Now, just a little insight here. Back in those days, there were various lots that these diviners and prognosticators would use. An example, let's make a note of Ezekiel 21, 21. You can read it later, and I'll just read it for you. It says, "For the king of Babylon stood at the parting of the way, at the head of the two ways, to use divination. He made his arrows bright. He consulted with images, and he looked in the liver." I gather it was normally a pig's liver, but in some cases it was a human liver. We won't go into the fact as to how they obtained it, but I wouldn't have been very happy to have been giving up mine. Let's put it that way. And these people had ways and means of coming to all sorts of bright conclusions, but the arrows was interesting. He said he mingled the arrows. What they do is they take all the arrows out of a quiver and say, right, now we're going to attack 10 cities. So they'd write the name of a city on each of the arrows, and they'd put them in the quiver and shake them all around, and somebody would pull an arrow out. Right, Jerusalem, let's go. That's how they worked. Having, of course, looked at the liver, and of course the prognosticators, of course, were giving support to the head man, weren't they? So what were they doing? They were doing like a lot of people are doing today. They were preaching to itching ears. They were preaching what people wanted to hear. They knew what the king wanted to do. He wanted to destroy this particular city more than any other. So this arrow comes out. And the king thinks, wow, these guys are really good. They back me up here. I'm right. And of course, the thing is, you know, when you go into something with a positive attitude, it's amazing how often it works. A positive attitude is probably one of the most important parts of our being. You know, when you look at what God is and what he's given us and what he promises us, can't we be positive? You can't really be very negative. You just can't be negative. Now, here comes the politics. See, this is still around after 2,500 years. The news of the world is gone after 136, yeah? I laughed at coming up with all this, over the years, you know, they've done this and they've exposed that. I'll tell you what they did. They were responsible for the death of Dr. Ray. It was a reporter from the News of the World that came scrawling around Ambassador College trying to stir up dirt. News of the World, don't even rest in peace. I'm glad you've gone. And you just see how these people have all been involved with government. It's nothing changed. It's all here. Just the same. That's why I've said this before and I'll say it again. How are you going to work with Abraham? How are you going to work with this? You're going to work with Job. Great builder, all right. Get old Andy here working with Job. How are you going to understand? You haven't got a JCB? What's a JCB? Think of those tall cranes, the dingy bits? That's not important. What's important is people. People, people, people. Do you know what? People haven't changed. Right from the beginning. Where's your brother? I don't know. I'm a brother's keeper. That's right at the beginning in Genesis with Cain and Abel, isn't it? And nothing changes. So here we go, verse 8. Haman said to the king Ahasuerus, there are certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom, and their laws are different. They're diverse from all the people. Neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore, it is not for the king's profit to suffer them. You see what that does? Hey? People in my kingdom not obeying my law? And my law is unbreakable, even if I make a law to my own hurt? I can't break it? Who are these people? If it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasuries. Now, 10,000 talents of silver was a pile. It was a lot of money. And the result, verse 10, and the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the Jew's enemy. And the king said to Haman, the silver is given to you, you can keep it. The people also, to do with them as seems good to you. Then obey my law, the trash, get rid of them. Then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month, and they were written according to all that Haman had commanded unto the king's lieutenants, and to the governors that were in every province, and so forth and so forth and so on. And the letters went out that the Jews were going to be killed. Not only that, but they were going to be killed on a specific day, 1 year hence. So, all right, maybe at the far extreme in India, it may have taken a few weeks for the letter to get there. But by and large, the Jews knew that in a year's time, they were all going to be destroyed. All of them. It's interesting. We don't want to make a real big thing about numbers. I know Bulger goes into it. But numbers are, they are there. And it's interesting, the slaughter was timed by divination, right, to occur on the 13th year of Ahasuerus' reign and on the 13th day. And 13 is the number that signifies rebellion, apostasy, defection, corruption, and revolution. Very interesting. Verse 14, the copy of the writing for a commandment to be given to every province was published unto all the people that they should be ready against that day. So you see, it took 12 months and these people now are looking at the Jews and thinking, hey, these guys are well off and we can have the prey, you see. It wasn't just kill the Jews, it's take all the Jews have got. Does that sound familiar? I wonder how much Nazi gold that they stole from the Jewish people in World War II is stuck in Swiss bank accounts. We might find out very shortly. And after this, when the decree had gone out, it says in verse 15, and the king and Haman sat down to drink. They were quite fond of doing that, weren't they? And when Mordecai perceived what was done, Mordecai rent his clothes and put on the sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city, crying with a loud and bitter cry. And he even came before the king's gate. but he couldn't go through it because he could not enter because of the sackcloth. Now, this is a very public display. Now, remember I said in the beginning, God is not mentioned in this book. Why? Because the whole book is about God and how he works. As we see this coming through, as it all works out. Verse 4 of chapter 4. Esther's maids, I'll just paraphrase this a little bit to try and get on, because there's quite a lot to get through here. Esther's maids come to her and they say, look, Mordecai is out there in sackcloth. So immediately, Esther doesn't know what's going on. She's in the palace. She's shut up from the world. She immediately sends him a whole bunch of new clothes. And verse 7, and Mordecai told this man that brought the clothes what was happening to him and the sum of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasury for the Jews to destroy them. And he gave a copy of this letter, this decree, and he said, go and take it to Esther. So again, Esther saw all this. And again, Esther spoke to Hattach and gave him commandment to Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whatsoever, whether a man or woman, shall come into the king in the inner court who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death. You didn't just walk in and say, morning, king, I want a word. You went in my appointment. And if the king wanted you, he extended the golden scepter. That meant, come on in. If he didn't, hasta la vista, baby. You are history. Gone. Finished. So going in front of the king could be a matter of life and death. So that's what Esther says. Who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter that he may live. But I have not been called to come into the king for these 30 days. So she not apparently been with the king for a month virtually. Then they told Mordecai Hester's words. So first of all, she sends him clothes, not understanding what's going on. Secondly, she says, hey, this is a bit risky here. You know, my life's on the line. And then Mordecai comes back. Verse 14, and he says, for if you altogether hold your peace at this time, then shall there be enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from one from another place, but thou and your father's house shall be destroyed. What he's saying is here, the whole Jewish race, including your good self, are going to be wiped out. And then he says something very interesting. For who knows whether you are come to the kingdom for such a time as this? You see God working here? Who knows that you're here to do a job? Esther then gets the point. Verse 16. And she says, go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan and fast you for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, day or night. I also and my maidens will fast likewise. And so shall I go into the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. You see, God's not mentioned here, but they're fasting for 3 days. Remember what Mr. Ball said in the updates the other week? Just quote him. He says, fasting was to be part of the process needed for effective communication with the Godhead. Today, regular fasting is not an option. It is there. It is here made a commandment because Christ, as a member of the Godhead in the flesh, is no longer humanly accessible. Access is today through prayer. Fasting, therefore, is a tool that helps us to keep and improve our contact with God. If ever there appears to be a problem with our communications with God, then we should fast. I put it to you, this is a real problem. The whole race is going to be wiped out. The whole Jewish race. So they fasted. God might not be mentioned, but it's talking about God all the time. Chapter 5. Now it came to pass on the third day that Esther put on her royal apparel and stood in the inner court of the king's house. Now this is where you could be seen from the throne. This is now in the danger zone, right? Over against the gate. At this point, God had to intervene. If that scepter had not been raised, Esther would have been executed. Verse 2 of chapter 5. And it was so when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court that she obtained favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. So Esther drew near and touched the top of the scepter. Then said the king, verse 3, what will you have, Queen Esther? Or what is your request? It shall be given you to unto half the kingdom. You see the favor here? So Esther jumped up and said, right, off with his head. No, there's wisdom here. Very, very, very deep wisdom. And Esther answered and said, if it seem good to the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto a banquet that I have prepared for him. Just the king and just Haman. So what does that tell Haman? Wow, I made it. Now, just me and him going to the queen for a banquet. So the king said, cause Haman to make haste that he may do as Esther has said. So the king and Haman come to the banquet that Esther has prepared. And the king said to Esther, the banquet with wine. So obviously the bottle's going. What is your petition? And it shall be granted you. Or what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be performed. Then answered Esther, she said, my petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition and to perform my request, let the king and Haman come to the banquet I shall prepare for them, and I will do tomorrow as the king asks. You know, one of the most effective tools, when I sold double glazing for a while between leaving college and going to South Africa, and my sales manager said to me, you know, he says, there's two things you need to learn. He says, when you've done your pitch and you've said to the people, that's the final deal. He says, shut up. The first person to speak loses. And that's a fact. That is a fact. Just shut up, because you've got to get them to speak. Because either they're going to say, okay, or they'll have a question which you can go back and answer. But all the time, you've got them on the hook. All the time. If you start blabbing, you've lost it. Right? And the other thing is, you say to them, well, double glazing, for instance, you look at the screen and say, well, you know, I don't know if you qualify for double glazing. Qualify? Yeah, well, I don't know, those windows are a bit, I don't know. I'll have to have a look at this carefully, you know. And you see, the fact that you're taking something away from them, oh, then they want it, don't they? And this is exactly what she did 2,500 years before double glazing, didn't she? Oh, no, come back tomorrow. I'll do another feast. I've got a whole store of wine down here. I'll get you nice and sozzled. Now, here's the interesting part now. Then went Haman forth that day, joyful with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he stood not up nor moved for him, he was full of indignation. Can you imagine this? He's just come out of a real good old booze up with the queen, most beautiful woman in the world there, and the king, and here am I in their presence, he's saying. I mean, wow. And he walks out, and he's like, yes! And his little Haman sitting there. Now he's wound up. Now there's steam coming out of his ears. Haman refrained himself. He managed somehow to hold himself together. And he went home, called for his friends and Zeresh, his wife. And Haman told them of the glory of his riches and the multitude of his children, all the things wherein the king had promoted him. And now he had advanced him above the princes and the servants of the king. And Haman said, moreover, yea, Esther the queen did let no man come in with the king into the banquet that he had prepared, but for myself, me, just me and the king. And tomorrow I'm invited back to another one. Yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting in the king's gate. You see the boiling up in him. He was consumed with hatred. Then said Zeresh his wife and all his friends unto him, let a gallows be made 50 cubits high. That's about 70 feet. Right? And tomorrow speak you unto the king that Mordecai may be hanged thereon. Then go thou merrily with the king unto the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. However, God intervenes again. Esther 6, verse 1. On the night, this is between the two banquets, the king couldn't sleep. And he commanded to bring the book of records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana, and Teresh, the two of the king's chamberlains, the keepers of the door, who sought to lay hands on the king. And the king said, "What honour and dignity has been done to Mordecai for this?" Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, "There's nothing done for him. He was never rewarded." And the king said, "Who's in the court?" Now Haman was come into the outward court of the king's house to speak unto the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he'd already prepared for him, 70 foot high. Do you know why? He wanted the whole city to see Mordecai up there. Because that would have been his power. Because all the other princes knew that Mordecai was just sitting there. "I ain't bowing. I'm not scraping to you, Amalekite." Yeah? So this was well known. And Haman wanted Mordecai. He wanted him swinging high. And the king's servant said, "Behold, Haman stands in the court." And the king says, "Oh, bring him in." So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What shall be done unto the man whom the king delights to honor?" Now Haman thought in his heart, "To whom would the king delight to do honor more than myself? Me, I." And Haman answered the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let the royal apparel be brought, which the king used to wear, and the horse that the king rides upon, and the royal crown set upon his head. And let this apparel and the horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array that man withal whom the king delights to honor, and bring him on horseback through the streets of the city, and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Where's that horse? Here's the put down. Then the king said to Haman, "Make haste and take the apparel and the horse, as you have said, and go and do so to Mordecai the Jew, that sits at the king's gate, let nothing fail of all that you've spoken." Isn't that just so good? You just want to laugh, don't you? You can just imagine the situation. He was not only boiling now. His gut would have been in a triple reef knot. You know, he thought he was getting all this, and he's got to go and give it to his worst enemy. So Mordecai came to the... Haman took the apparel and the horse, and he arrayed Mordecai. He has to actually stick the clothes on him, put the crown on his head, give him a leg up onto the horse, and parade him through the streets, proclaiming him to the population. "This is the man the king honors." You can even today, 2,500 years later, you can feel it, can't you? It's unbelievable. And Mordecai came to the king's gate, but Haman hasted to his house mourning and having his head covered. Remember, this is between the two banquets, yeah? And Haman told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened, everything that had befallen him. Then said his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, unto him, "If Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews, before whom you have begun to fall, you shall not prevail against him, but shall surely fall before him." And while they were yet talking to him, and you can imagine the mood in the room, came the king's chamberlains and hasted to bring Haman to the banquet that Hester had prepared. So just try to get the emotion here now, right? He's just had the biggest slap down of anybody ever, right? And he's now got to go back into the palace for this second banquet, and he's got to be smelling some kind of a rat. 7 verse 1. So the king and Haman came to the banquet with Esther the queen, and the king said again to Esther on the second day of the banquet of wine, "What is your petition, Queen Esther, and it shall be granted you, and what is your request, and it shall be performed, even to half the kingdom." Then Esther the queen answered and said, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. But if we had been sold for bondsmen and bondswomen, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could not contravail the king's damage." You see how she put it? "Yeah, I'm your wife, and these are my people. So I'm for the chop as well." The king got the point. Then King Ahasuerus answered and said unto Esther the queen, who is he, and where is he that durst presume in his heart to do so? And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is the wicked Haman. Then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen. And the king, rising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden. He went out there to cool off. I don't think seeing somebody like the king of Persia having a strop, it would have been much fun. Because this is a man that can just cough the wrong way and people will just get exterminated, yeah? And Haman stood up to make his request for his life to Esther the queen, for he saw that there were evil determined against him by the king. Verse 8, then the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine, and Haman had fallen upon the bed whereupon Esther was. He's probably on his knees begging for his life. But of course the king came in and thought he was seeing a slightly different situation and said, will you force the queen also before me in the house? As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. The king got up in rage, left his wine, and went into the palace garden. But Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. That's what he was doing. The king thought it was something else, which only made him a little bit madder. Verse 8 of chapter 7. Just as the king returned into the palace garden to the banqueting hall, Haman had fallen upon the couch, and he said, will you molest the queen while she is with me in my house? And they covered his face. Now, covering the face is interesting, because this is a thing that goes back to many, many, many different cultures. Evidently, when a criminal was condemned by a Roman judge, he was delivered to the sergeants with these words, go, sergeant, cover his head and hang him upon the accursed tree. And I believe when they used to hang people in this country, they would cover the face. And Halbaniah, one of the chamberlains, said before the king also, the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman has made for Mordecai, who has spoken good for the king, stands in the house of Haman. Then the king said, hang him thereon. Hung on his own gallows. So they hanged Haman on the gallows which he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. This is chapter 8, verse 1. On that day did the king Ahasuerus give the house of Haman, the Jews' enemy, unto Esther the queen. All that was Haman's was given to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was unto her. So obviously Esther had to say to the queen, look, he's basically my dad, in a sense. And of course the king would have realized that this man had saved his life. He'd brought up this woman who was just beautiful and highly educated, probably. She was full of wisdom. She was full of judgment. She was a beautiful person whom he loved dearly. So, of course, Mordecai was stuck on a pedestal. And the king took off his ring, which he had taken back from Haman, and gave it unto Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So Esther had been given the house of Haman. So she gave all that property and all the wealth of Haman to Mordecai. And they had the ring. They had the signet. They could speak on behalf of the king, in other words. And Esther spake yet again to the king and fell down at his feet and besought him with tears to put away the mischief of Haman, the Agagite, and his device that he had devised against the Jews. Now there's a problem, you see. This proclamation had gone out. And they were going to slaughter all the Jews. It could not be retracted. And again, here's the wisdom of Mordecai and Esther. If it please the king, if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right before the king, and I be pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews, which are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that shall come unto my people, and how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? So, I mean, the king would have been just wanted to do. Well, he basically said to her, whatever you want to do, you guys are going to do it. You've got the ring, just write it, stick my seal on it, and that's the way it's going to be. And he says, write you also for the Jews as it likes you in the king's name and seal it with the king's ring, for the writing which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's ring may no man reverse. So Mordecai went out, verse 15, from the presence of the king in the royal apparel of blue and white, and with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. There was a large Jewish presence in the city. And the Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and in every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a good day. And many of the people of the land became Jews, for fear of the Jews had fallen upon them. In other words, many of the people that lived, maybe Persians, maybe people from other nations, became Jews. They took on the Jewish religion. Now in the 12th month, this is Esther chapter 9. Now in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's commandment and his decree drew near to be put to execution, in the day that the enemies of the Jews hoped to have power over them, and then in brackets it says, though it was turned to the contrary, the Jews had rule over them that hated them, the Jews gathered themselves together in their cities throughout all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus to lay hand on such as sought their hurt. And no man could withstand them, for the fear of them fell upon all the people. In other words, what Esther and Mordecai wrote was that those who were, because obviously you had a year to sort all this out. So you can imagine the polarization that took place within the population. There would be the one lot that would say, hey, right, we can wipe this lot out, and because they've got all this property, they've got all these businesses, all this money and so on, and it can all be ours. So the Jews would know who they were, because you think they weren't taunting them in the street. Yeah, yeah, the day's coming. Yeah, just check the calendar, next month, next week. But not so. The Jews were given the power to defend themselves. Not just to defend themselves, but to take revenge on their enemies. You drop down to verse 5 of chapter 9. Thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword and slaughter and destruction, and did what they would unto those that hated him. And in Shushan the palace, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men. She was certainly no shrinking violet, was Esther, was she? Then said Esther, if it please the king, let it be granted to the Jews which are in Shushan to do tomorrow also according to this king's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged upon the gallows. She hadn't done yet, had she? Get rid of the whole family. And the king commanded it so to be done, and the decree was given at Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. Let's see, we can probably drop down now to verse 16. But the other Jews that were in the king's provinces gathered themselves together and stood for their lives and had rest from their enemies and slew of their foes 75,000 people. 75,000 people throughout the Persian Empire were slaughtered by the Jews, because they were the ones that were going to be doing the slaughtering, they thought. So not only did he turn the thing against Haman, all of his henchmen as well suffered the same fate. And Mordecai, verse 20, wrote these things and sent letters unto all the Jews that were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both nigh and far, to establish this among them, that they should keep the 14th day of the month of Adar and the 15th day of the same yearly, as the days wherein the Jews rested from their enemies, and the month which was turned unto them from sorrow to joy and from mourning into a good day, and they should make them days of feasting and joy and of sending portions one to another and gifts to the poor. And the Jews undertook to do as they had begun and as Mordecai had written to them. And to this day, the Jews keep Purim. The Jews keep Purim. Verse 24. Because Haman the son of Hammedatha and the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews, had devised against the Jews to destroy them and had cast Pur, that is the lot, to consume them and to destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letters that his wicked device, which he devised against the Jews, should return upon his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Wherefore these days were called Purim after the name Pur, which means lot. Therefore, for all the words of this letter, and of that which they have seen concerning this matter, and which had come unto them, the Jews ordained and took upon themselves, and upon their seed, and upon all such as joined themselves unto them, so as it should not fail, that they would keep these 2 days according to their writings, and according to their appointed time every year. And that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, every city. And that these days of Purim should not fail from among the Jews, nor the memorial of them perish from their seed. That was 2,500, roughly, 2,500 years ago, and it's still being kept today. Then Esther the queen, the daughter, this is verse 29 now of chapter 9, the daughter of Abihail and Mordecai the Jew, wrote with all authority to confirm the second letter of Purim. And he sent the letters unto all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus with words of peace and truth. This is chapter 10 now, just 3 verses. And the king Ahasuerus laid the tributes upon the land and upon the isles of the sea, and all the acts of his power and of his might, and of the declaration of the greatness of Mordecai, whereunto the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? And oh, would it not be wonderful if that would turn up? But you know what would happen to it? It would disappear. Nobody would want to bring this up. Just imagine if the true record of what Mordecai did was lying around in the bottom of the Vatican Library, and somebody got in and photocopied it or whatever and revealed it, that all this, as it happened, could be verified from the annals of the Medes and the Persians, they wouldn't have a leg to stand on, would they? But you see, they're still... The other day I saw an article about... They think maybe they found the city of David, because nobody can really prove that David existed. Boy, are they going to get a shock. They are going to get one really, really, really big shock. And Mordecai the Jew was next unto the king, and great among the Jews, and accepted all the multitude of his brethren, seeking the wealth of his people, and speaking peace to all his seed. What a difference from Haman. All Haman wanted to do was ride around the horse with the crown on, and everybody bowing and scraping to him. Haman, seeking wealth of his people and speaking peace to all his seed. Right, let's go to the conclusion now. In the beginning, we asked the question, well, we read the scripture. Now, all these things happen to them for examples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world has come. So what are the lessons in this book? Well, while God is not mentioned in the book is all about him, and it shows how he controls kings and leaders. And it's all about God and how he works. I gave a sermonette some years ago, I think, here. It was the very first sermonette I ever gave at Ambassador College. But I went into the king's heart is in the hand of the gardeners, the rivers of water. And the ancient gardens, they'd have these irrigation channels. And the gardener would literally water with his foot, as it said in Deuteronomy, I think it is. He put his foot in and just fill the little gap in and take the water somewhere else. That's how God deals with kings. It's just no effort for him to raise one up and squash one down. And isn't this what we're seeing here? Isn't this what we've just read? When trouble came, Esther and the people fasted to draw close to God, which of course is what we're encouraged to do. The book of Esther shows us God's power in action, raising people up and removing them. Why? So his plan can be fulfilled. Because whether Cyrus was exactly her son or not, it set the precedent. The Jews suddenly became a positive force within the Persian Empire, which led to them being sent back into Israel to rebuild the temple. Now, God had prophesied that 200 years before by Isaiah. So it came about. But God made it come about. He manipulates people, because this plan, which started at Adam, is going to be fulfilled. I'll tell you what, it's going to be fulfilled on exactly the right day according to his reckoning. There's several indications of scripture. Remember, they came out of Egypt on the 430th day, exactly on the day. Why? Because that was God's plan. Make a note of Deuteronomy 32, verse 39. I'll just read it to you, because this is what God says about himself. See now that I am he, and there is no God with me. I kill, I make alive. I wound, I heal. Neither is there any that can deliver out of my hand. Remember what he said to Moses? Moses said, who shall I say sent me? Think of the job Moses was given. You know, must have been some people who remembered him. But now he's been chasing sheep around the hills for 40 years. And now he's going to go back to Egypt and whip this people into action and get them out of the country. Go through all the thing with all the plagues and all the rest of it. He said to me, well, what am I going to say to them? Who's sending me? Did God go into a great big preamble about everything? He just said, just tell them, I am sent you. I am. How simple is that to believe? It's just all encompassing. That's what God says. There's none that can deliver out of my hand. We've got to keep in mind that all will be done in accordance with God's plan. And we've just read an example of it, 2,500 years old, yes. But in great detail as to how God worked it out, because God is in absolute total control. But there's more, much more, which only God's people can truly understand. And this is the fact that it would seem very much so that the book of Esther reveals the outline of the plan of God. Think about it. Vashti, the first wife, would not obey her husband. Israel? Ancient Israel? Would not obey God, and they were banished. They lost out. Mordecai, the Redeemer, he protected Esther. He guided Esther. He provided with Esther. He was at her right hand the whole way through. Looks very much like a type of Christ. Esther, a type of the church. In fact, I must smile. When I started to see this as I was studying the book, I thought, yeah. If you think, remember when Mordecai was out in the street, pulling his hair out and sackcloth and ashes and the whole thing? It came to her and she said, I'll send you some clothes. She didn't get it, did she? She didn't get it. So she sends a servant out and says, what's wrong with Mordecai? So Mordecai comes back and he says, look, there's the petition. This is what's going to happen. And she sits there thinking, hey, I go in there, get the chop. So again, she goes back to Mordecai. And then Mordecai makes that interesting statement. He says, how do you not know that you were put where you were put for a special purpose? You see? Then she got the point. Then you have the same attitude as Ruth had. I'll do the job, and if I perish, I perish. Haman, oh, surely a type of Satan, overblown with his own self-importance, his lust for power, consumed with hatred against Mordecai and the whole Jewish race. He had the power. He had the signet ring of the king. Satan is the god of this world. He has the signet ring. He's the ruler of this planet right now. And he's about to lose it. Do you remember? All the beauty, the talent. God created him perfect. He must have been one of the most stunning things to look on, if you have the eyes to see him, that is. He had everything. He had everything. And you know, Haman had everything. He had the king's ring. Do you know what they used to do back then? The king normally had two signet rings, evidently. And the man that was chosen to make the ring, when he had done the job, was blinded so that he could not make another ring. Yeah? That's how powerful that ring was. When they did a seal and stuck it in there, it was just as if it had come from the king of Persia. So Haman, literally, he lost the signet ring and it went to Mordecai. Just as the rulership of this world is passing very shortly now from Satan to Christ as Christ comes back. And what did Esther call him? The adversary, the enemy, the wicked Haman. Is that not what we call Satan? The adversary, Mordecai then becomes the ruler. He becomes second in the kingdom. He was like the prime minister. We have the church, Esther, there with him. They're working together. He performs all in the king's name. All fear him. Many are converted. And what follows? An age of peace and prosperity. It's the millennium. Now, if you go back and read the book of Esther, and just look at all the little things that happen, you can see it fits in with that pretty accurately. Now, here's the so what. You know, whenever one of the things, we had a series of sermonettes given at Ambassador College in class, where we were being taught how to lay things out and all the rest of it. And we had two or three real bloopers. And I remember Mr. Dart just sitting there like this. And I thought, oh, something's going to happen just now. I could see he was kind of like getting a little bit uneasy. And eventually he's banged the table and he says, "So what? You've all wasted my time this morning. So what? What do you want me to get out of this?" Well, here's the so what. God has chosen us to play a part in this end time work every bit as much as he chose Esther and Mordecai back here. Each of us was handpicked by God the Father. John 6:44. Not even Christ selected us. No man can come to me except the Father which has sent me draw him. We were each drawn by God the Father himself. And the promise is, Christ says, "And I will raise him up at the last day." And then you make a note of 1 Corinthians 12, verse 18. "But now hath God set the members, every one of them, in the body, as it has pleased him." That's why we're here. At the moment, you look at the group, and so many of us are, as Paul said to me recently, he says, the end's got to come quickly, otherwise there'll be nobody left. Because a lot of us are approaching our sell-by date. Certainly our best before date. We are going to be kings and priests, reigning and ruling with Christ. Think of Revelation 3. What does Christ say? "I'm going to put my new name on you." His new authority. He said, "I'm going to put the name of my Father on you." The authority of God the Father. "I'm going to put the authority of the Holy Jerusalem on you." Is there anything else you want? Think about it. Think about the setting back here. When Haman walked out of there with that crown on his head and that ring on his finger, he was second in command of the government of the whole earth. And all he wanted for his people was prosperity and peace. So the last thing I'd like to leave with you is this. Remember what Christ said, "Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom, and I am with you always, even until the end of the age." Amen.